The five human types. How to read people using the science of human analysis. Volume 2. The Thriller. Introduction. In this chapter, we will cover fundamentals of human analysis. You may want to refresh these points. Alternatively, go to the next chapter if you already covered this material in other volumes. Modern science has proved that the fundamental traits of every individual are indelibly stamped in the shape of his body, head, face, and hands, an X-ray by which you can read the characteristics of any person on sight. The most essential thing in the world to any individual is to understand himself. The next is to understand the other fellow. For life is largely a problem of running your own car as it was built to be run, plus getting along with the other drivers on the highway. From this book you are going to learn which type of car you are and the main reasons why you haven't been getting the maximum of service out of yourself. Also, you are going to learn the makes of other human cars and how to get the maximum of cooperation out of them. This cooperation is vital to happiness and success. We come in contact with our fellow men in all the activities of our lives, and what we get out of our lives depends to an astounding degree on our relations with him. The greatest problem facing any organism is successful reaction to its environment. Environment, scientifically speaking, is the sum total of your experiences. In plain United States, this means fitting vocationally, socially, and maritally into the place where you are. If you don't fit, you must move or change your environment to fit you. If you can't change the environment and you won't move, you will become a failure. Just as tropical plants fail when transplanted to the Nevada desert. But there is something that grows and keeps on growing in the Nevada desert. The sagebrush. It couldn't move away and it couldn't change its waterless environment. So it did what you and I must do if we expect to succeed. It adapted itself to its environment, and there it stands, each little stalwart shrub a reminder of what even a plant can do when it tries. Human life faces the same alternatives that confront all other forms of life, of adapting itself to the conditions under which it must live or become extinct. You have an advantage over the sagebrush in that you can move from your city or state or country to another. But after all, that's not much of an advantage, for though you may improve your situation slightly, you will still find that in any civilized country, the main elements of your problem are the same. So long as you live in a civilized or thickly populated community, you will still need to understand your own nature and the natures of other people. No matter what you desire of life, other people's aims, ambitions, and activities constitute vital obstructions along your pathway. You will never get far without the cooperation, confidence, and comradeship of other men and women. It wasn't always so, and its recentness in human history may account for some of our blindness to this great fact. In primitive times, people saw each other rarely and had much less to do with each other. The human element was then not the chief problem. Their environmental problems had to do with such things as violent storms, extremes of heat and cold, darkness, the ever-present menace of wild beasts whose flesh was their food, yet who would eat them first unless they were quick in brain and body. But all that is changed. Man has subjugated all other creatures and now walks the earth its supreme sovereign. He has discovered and invented and built. And now we live in skyscrapers, talk around the world without wires, and by pressing a button, turn darkness into daylight. Yet with all our knowledge of the outside world, 99 lives out of every 100 are comparative failures. The reason is plain to every scientific investigator. We have failed to study ourselves in relation to the great environmental problem of today. The stage setting has been changed, but not the play. The game is the same old game. You must adjust and adapt yourself to your environment or it will destroy you. The cities of today look different from the jungles of our ancestors, and we imagine that because the brain of man overcame the old menaces, no new ones have arisen to take their place. We no longer fear extermination from cold. We turn on the heat. We're not afraid of the vast oceans, but pass swiftly, safely, and luxuriously over their surfaces. and we can have breakfast in New York and dine the same evening in San Francisco. But in building up this stupendous superstructure of modern civilization, man has brought into being a society so intricate and so complex that he now faces the new environmental problem of human relationships. Today, we depend for life's necessities almost wholly upon the activities of others. The work of thousands of human hands and thousands of human brains lies back of every meal you eat, every journey you take, every book you read, every bed in which you sleep, every telephone conversation, every email you receive, and every garment you wear. And this fellow man of ours has multiplied since that dim distant dawn into 6 billion human beings by the end of the 20th century, with at least half of them after the very things you want, and not a tenth enough to go round. Who will win? Nature answers for you. She has said, with awful and inexorable finality, that whether you are a blade of grass on the Nevada desert or a man in the streets of London, you can win only as you adapt yourself to your environment. Today, our environmental problem consists largely of the other fellow. Only those who learn to adapt themselves to their fellows can win great or lasting rewards. To do this, it is necessary to better understand our neighbors, to recognize that people differ from each other in their likes and dislikes, traits, talents, tendencies, and capabilities. The combination of these makes each individual's nature. It isn't difficult to understand others, for with each group of these traits, there always goes its corresponding physical makeup, the externals whereby the internal is invariably indicated. This is true with every species on the globe and with every subdivision within each species. All dogs belong to the same species, but there is a great difference between the nature of St. Bernard and that of a terrier, just as there is a decided difference between the natures of different human beings. But in both instances, the actions, reactions, and habits of each can be accurately anticipated on sight by the shape, size, and structure of the two creatures. When a terrier comes into the room, you instinctively draw away, unless you want to be jumped at and greeted effusively. But you make no such movement to protect yourself from St. Bernard, because you read on sight the different natures of these two from their external appearance. You know a rose, a violet, a sunflower, and an orchid, and what perfume you are sure to find in each by the same method. All are flowers, and all belong to the same species, just as all humans belong to the same species. But their respective size, shape, and structure tell you in advance and on sight what their respective characteristics are. The same is true of all human beings. They differ in certain fundamentals, but always and invariably in accordance with their differences in size, shape, and structure. The reason for this is plain. Goaded by the instinct of self-preservation, man, like all other living things, has made heroic efforts to meet the demands of his environment. He has been more successful than any other creature and is, as a result, the most complex organism on the earth. But his most baffling complexities resolve themselves into comparatively simple terms once it is recognized that each internal change brought about by his environment brought with it the corresponding external mechanism without which he couldn't have survived. So today we see man a highly evolved creature who not only acts but thinks and feels. All these thoughts, feelings, and emotions are interrelated. The body and the mind of man are so closely bound together that whatever affects one affects the other. An instantaneous change of mind instantly changes the muscles of the face. A violent thought instantly brings violent bodily movements. The film industry, one of the largest in the world, is based primarily on this interrelation. This industry would become extinct if something were to happen to sever the connection between external expressions and the internal nature of men and women. How much do external characteristics tell about a man? They tell, with amazing accuracy, all the basic fundamental principal traits of his nature. The size, shape, and structure of man's body tell more important facts about his real self, what he thinks and what he does, than the average mother ever knows about her own child. If this sounds impossible, If the seeming incongruity, multiplicity, and heterogeneity of human qualities have baffled you, remember that this is exactly how the print in all books and newspapers baffled you before you learned to read. Not long ago, I was reading stories aloud to a 3-year-old. She wanted to see the pictures, and when told there were none, had to be shown the book. "What funny little marks," she cried, pointing to the print. "How do you get stories out of them?" Printing looked to all of us, at first, just masses of meaningless little marks. But after a few days at school, how things did begin to clear up. It wasn't a jumble after all. There was something to it. It straightened itself out until the funny little marks became significant. Each of them had a meaning, and the same meaning under all conditions. Through them, your whole outlook on life became deepened and broadened, all because you learned the meaning of 26 little letters and their combinations. Learning to read men and women is a more delightful process than learning to read books, for every person you see is a true story, more romantic and absorbing than any ever bound in covers. Learning to read people is also a simpler process than learning to read books, because there are fewer letters in the human alphabet. Though man seems to the untrained eye a mystifying mass of funny little marks, he is not now difficult to analyze. This is because there are, after all, but a few kinds of human feelings. Some form of hunger, love, hate, fear, hope or ambition gives rise to every human emotion and every human thought. Our actions follow our thoughts. Every thought, however transitory, causes muscular action, which leaves its trace in that part of the physical organism which is most closely allied to it. Look into the mirror the next time you are angry, happy, surprised, tired or sorrowful, and note the changes wrought by your emotions in your facial muscles. Constant repetition of the same kinds of thoughts or emotions finally makes permanent changes in that part of the body which is physiologically related to these mental activities. The jaw is a good illustration of this alliance between the mind and the body. Its muscles and bones are so closely allied to the pugnacity instinct center in the brain that the slightest thought of combat causes the jaw muscles to stiffen. Let the thought of any actual physical encounter go through your mind, and your jawbone will automatically move upward and outward. After a lifetime of combat, whether by fists or words, the jaw sets permanently a little more upward and outward, a little more like that of the bulldog. It keeps to this combative mold because, says Mother Nature, the great efficiency expert, if you are going to call on me constantly to stiffen that jaw, I'll fix it, so that it will stay that way and save myself the trouble. Thus, the more combative jaw, having become permanent in the man's organism, can be passed on to his children. Right here comes a most interesting law, and one that has made possible the science of human analysis. The larger any part or organ, the better its equipment for carrying out the work of that organ, and the more does it tend to express itself. Nature is an efficiency expert and doesn't give you an oversupply of anything without demanding that you use it. Our ancestors developed massive jaws as a result of constant combat. As fast as civilization decreased the necessity for combat, nature decreased the size of the average human jaw. But whenever you see a large protruding jaw, you see an individual armed and engined, as Kipling says, for some kind of fighting. The large jaw always goes with a combative nature, whether it is found on a man or a woman, a child or a minister. The large jaw, therefore, is seen to be both a result and a cause of certain things. As the inheritance of a fighting ancestor, it is the result of millions of years of fighting in prehistoric times, and, like any other overdeveloped part or organ, it has an intense urge to express itself. This inherent urge is what makes the owner of that jaw fight at the drop of the head and often have a chip on his shoulder. Thus, because every external characteristic is the result of natural laws and chiefly of natural selection, the vital traits of any creature can be read from his externals. Every student of biology, anatomy, anthropology, ethnology or psychology is familiar with these facts. Man's organism has developed, altered, improved and evolved down through the slow revolving years, with one instinctive aim, successful reaction to its environment. Every part has been laboriously constructed to that sole end. Because of this, its functions are marked as clearly upon it as those of a grain elevator, a steamship, or a piano. Nature has no accidents. She wastes no material, and everything has a purpose. If you put up a good fight to live, she will usually come to your rescue and give you enough of whatever is needed to tide you over. If you don't, she says you're not fit to people the earth and lets you go without a pang. Thus she weeds out all but the strong, and evolution marches on. This inherent potentiality for altering the organism to meet the demands of the environment is especially noticeable in races, and is the main reason for most racial differences. Differences in environment, climate, altitude and topography necessitated most of these physical differentiations, which today enable us to know at a glance whether a man belongs to the white race, the yellow race or the black race. The results of these differentiations and modifications will be told in the various chapters of this book. The student of human analysis reads the disposition and nature of every individual with ease, regardless of whether that individual be an American, a Frenchman, an Eskimo, or a Chinaman, because human analysis explains those fundamental traits which run through every race, color, and nationality, according to externals, which always go with those traits. Human analysis differs from every other system of character analysis in that it classifies man into five types according to his biological evolution. It deals with man in the light of scientific discoveries. It estimates each individual according to his human qualities rather than his character or so-called moral qualities. In other words, it takes his measure as a human being and determines from his externals his chances for success in the world of today. Every rule in this book is based on scientific data, has been proved to be accurate by investigations and surveys of all kinds of people in all parts of the world. These rules don't work merely part of the time, they work all the time, under all conditions, and apply to every individual of every race, every color, every country, every community, and every family. Through this human science, you can learn to read people as easily as you read books, if you will take the little time and pains to learn the rules which compose your working alphabet. It is easy to know what an individual will do under most circumstances, because every human being does what he wants to do, in the way he prefers to do it most of the time. If you doubt, try this test. Bring to mind any intimate friends, or even that husband or wife, and note how few changes they've made in the way of doing things in 20 years. Every human being is born with preferences and predilections, which manifest themselves from earliest childhood to death. These inborn tendencies are never obliterated and seldom controlled to any great extent, and even then only by individuals who have learnt the power of the mind over the body. Inasmuch as this knowledge is possessed by only a few, most of the people of the earth are blindly following the dictates of their inborn learnings. In other words, more than 99% of all the people you know are following their natural bents in reacting to all their experiences, from the most trivial incidents to the most far-reaching emergencies. The individual is seldom conscious of these habitual acts of his, much less of where he got them. The nearest he comes is to say he got it from his father, or she takes it from grandmother. But where did grandmother get it? Science has taken the trouble to investigate, and today we know not only where grandmother got it, but what she did with it. She got it along with her size, shape and structure, in other words, from her type. And she did just what you and everybody else does with his type characteristics. She acted in accordance with her type. Just as a canary sings like a canary, instead of talking like a parrot. And just as a rose gives off rose perfume, instead of violet. This law holds throughout every species and explains man, who likes to think himself a deep mystery, as it explains every other creature. Look around you in shop, office, field or home, and you will find that the quick, alert, impulsive man is acting quickly, alertly and impulsively most of the time. Nothing less than a calamity slows him down, and then only temporarily, while the slow, patient, mild and passive individual is acting slowly, patiently, mildly and passively in spite of all goads. Some overwhelming passion or crisis may speed him up momentarily, but as soon as it fades, he reverts to his old slow habits. Human analysis is the science which shows you how to recognize the slow man, the quick man, the stubborn man, the yielding man, the leader, the learner, and all other basic kinds of men on sight from the shape, size, and structure of their bodies. Certain bodily shapes indicate predispositions to fatness, leanness, boniness, muscularity, and nervousness, and this predisposition is so much part of the warp and woof of the individual that he cannot disguise it. The urge given to him by this inborn mechanism is so strong as to be practically irresistible. Every experience of his life calls forth some kind of reaction, and invariably the reaction will be similar, in every vital respect, to the reactions of other people who have bodies of the same general size, shape, and structure as his own. No person achieves success or happiness when compelled to do what he naturally dislikes to do. Since these likes and dislikes stay with him to the grave, one of the biggest modern problems is that of helping men and women to discover and to capitalize their inborn traits. Every individual does best those things which permit him to act in accordance with his natural bents. This explains why we like best those things we do best. It takes real enthusiasm to make a success of any undertaking, for nothing less than enthusiasm can turn on a full current. We struggle from the cradle to the grave for self-expression, and everything that pushes us in a direction opposed to our natural tendencies is done half-heartedly, inefficiently, and unwillingly. These are the steps that lead straight to failure, yet failure can be avoided and success approximated by every normal person if he will take the same precaution with his own machinery that he takes with his car.